Goddag og velkommen til Langsomme Samtaler. Mit navn er Rune Lykkeberg. Jeg har i den her uge talt med den amerikanske økonom og professor James Galbraith. Han er født i 1952 og søn af en af de mest berømte amerikanske økonomer i det 20. århundrede, John Kenneth Galbraith, som har været en kæmpe helt her på Dagbladet Information. Blandt andet skrev John Kenneth Galbraith bogen The Affluent Society, som blev et hovedværk for studiet af den nye forbrugskultur og den form for forbrugskapitalisme, der opstod i de vestlige samfund i anden halvdel af det 20. århundrede. John Kenneth Galbraith var en særlig figur, fordi han både var en stor økonom på Harvard, han var en vigtig rådgiver for fem på hinanden følgende amerikanske administrationer og en vigtig intellektuel i den amerikanske debat. Hans søn, James Galbraith, har på samme måde været en stor forsker inden for økonomi. Han har selv arbejdet i kongressen, da han var helt ung, og han er en vigtig intellektuel i den amerikanske offentlighed. Han er på mange måder gået i sin fars fodspor, og han udgiver lige om lidt det, der må blive hans karrieres hovedværk, nemlig Entropy Economics, som er et totalt opgør med den måde, man har tænkt økonomi på i hans tid som professor, og som er i forlængelse af hans far. Jeg mødte for første gang James Galbraith i 2012, da jeg var i Texas for at dække det amerikanske præsidentvalg, der dengang stod mellem Mitt Romney og Barack Obama. Vi troede i 2012, at det her ligesom var kulminationen på pengenes indflydelse i amerikansk politik, at Mitt Romney, som både var tidligere guvernør i Massachusetts, men som også var en amerikansk rigmand, der nu ville være præsident, var en slags undtagelse. Dengang sagde James Galbraith, at det her var første gang plutokratiet viste sit ærlige ansigt til åbenlyst i amerikansk politik. Og lige siden har jeg tænkt på, at jeg har lyst til at interviewe James Galbraith igen, fordi det vi har set i de seneste uger, efter Donald Trump er blevet præsident, er en helt anderledes åben skamløshed omkring pengenes magt i amerikansk politik. Vi har set rige mænd som Jeff Bezos, Mark Zuckerberg, Sam Altman og selvfølgelig mest prominent Elon Musk forkaste alt, hvad de tidligere har sagt, de troede på for at tilslutte sig Donald Trump og for at være en del af hans sejr og især for ikke at få hans magt imod sig. Så jeg har været nysgerrig på de seneste måneder, hvordan James Galbraith han ville fortolke det, der sker i øjeblikket. Og selvfølgelig det underliggende spørgsmål er hele tiden for mig. Har pengenes magt i amerikansk politik nået en slags point of no return? Har oligarkerne fået så meget magt, så demokratiet ikke længere kan drage dem til ansvar, men blot er et mere eller mindre beredvilligt instrument for dem? Det lyder selvfølgelig drastisk, og det lyder selvfølgelig meget marxistisk, men jeg mener faktisk, det er der, vi er, at det er den slags spørgsmål, man må stille til det amerikanske demokrati i 2024. Men jeg ved også, at James Galbraith, som er en skånselsløs kritiker af den amerikanske økonomi og af det amerikanske oligarki, er en meget, meget stor tilhænger af det amerikanske demokrati, og har uendelig meget tillid til, på trods af alt, hvad han har set og alt, hvad han har oplevet, at den offentlige debat faktisk betyder noget, og at det, vi ved om samfundet, kan omsættes til handling i samfundet. Så han er en stor demokratisk optimist, men også en meget stor økonomisk realist i sin betragtning af de amerikanske samfundsforhold. Så jeg har længe set frem til at tale med James Galbraith, og jeg starter med at spørge ham, hvordan det er at være søn af en så berømt økonom og følge i fodsporene på en mand, man aldrig nogensinde kommer til at overgå, men alligevel godt kan blive vigtig og på en eller anden måde bære faklen videre, uden at skulle realisere sig selv helt forfra, men netop som en slags følge i generationer, der er en del af den samme kamp. Det lyder meget konservativt, men det er i James Galbraiths tilfælde faktisk også meget progressivt. Så vi starter med at tale om, hvordan det er at være søn af John Kenneth Galbraith, og så når vi hele vejen rundt, og vi ender et sted, som er relativt optimistisk. Men før vi kommer derhen, så skal vi igennem rigtig meget mørke. Her følger min samtale med professor ved Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs ved University of Texas i Austin, James Galbraith. Thank you so much for taking your time. It's a privilege to talk to you twice.
You have to understand about time with professors. It's the one thing that's in complete surplus.
Okay. And the question about your father, is that okay? Because you often refer to him, so I thought it would be interesting to ask about it.
My relationship with my father's work?
Yeah.
Very, very straightforward. Some years ago, I was at a function in New York, and I encountered an old friend of mine who taught at Sarah Lawrence, whose name was Frank Roosevelt. He was the grandson. And he looked at me with a collegial and mournful expression and said, "We bear a terrible burden with our father's names." And I said, "Frank, what the," well, I used a rather rude word, "what the devil are you talking about?" And he looked at me with considerable surprise. And I said, "You know, it's not Bush. It's not Reagan." And he said, "You know, you have a point. I feel better already." This is the fundamental problem. It just caused me a certain amount of grief as a teenager because you're expected to have a rebellion against your parents, and I missed that phase. But since then, I've been quite comfortable with it.
I want to ask you just one question about, because he, you know, your father was a very big figure here in Denmark, a very celebrated intellectual and economist. And the Affluent Society was, for this newspaper, a book that was referred to for decades, actually. And still, it's still being read by some of our readers. And one
and
thing,
if you look on the dedication of that page of that book, you'll find my name.
I never noticed that.
Yes.
I always admired your father's way of combining intellectual work and political work, that he was an original thinker, he was a researcher, and he was close to policy at the same time. It's very rare to operate in that intersection the way he did. It's more common in America than it is here, though. How would you describe his position?
Well, first of all, I'd take a modest exception to your use of the term researcher. Because this was not the way my father was raised and not the tradition that he was brought up in. He was a farm boy. And his first body of work was about farming. It was about the specific problems and situations that faced the people in southern Ontario where he was growing up. And then he moved to California, and he worked on agricultural economics. He worked on, for example, the marketing of honey in California. He did a dissertation on the expenditure pattern of California counties. And then he moved on and became engaged in industrial issues. And at that time also became exposed to Keynes and to the general theory year in Cambridge. So all through his life, he was rooted in this basic New Deal era pragmatism. And that then informed his vision of how the larger economy functions. So he came from, and then of course he had massive responsibilities, not just with price control in the Second World War, but with a number of things before that, including the siting of industrial facilities for munitions and other matters. So he was a person who came through a practical upbringing into major responsibilities, and then distilled that. Oh, and also journalism at Fortune, brought him into contact with the leadership of the American corporate world. And so he distilled all of that into a portrait of the American economy and this period of its, you might call it climacteric in the 50s and 60s, and into the 1970s. And he captured that better than anybody else did, because he was precisely not operating out of an academic foundation, of a purely academic foundation. And that gave him a considerable advantage over people who were trained as academic economists or who came to the country from some, tradition that was substantially neoclassical or ordo-liberal in the European sense of those terms, and who came over in many cases as refugees and installed themselves at the apex of American academic life. He came from an entirely different intellectual formation.
I was thinking of him recently because he was working with rationing and price controls during the Second World War at the Office of Price Administration. And I was thinking of what they were actually doing at the time, because the question of price controls has been brought up again. And I think Isabella Mweba has been very influential here, and you've supported her work. And it was brought up during the election campaign as well by Kamala Harris in a very vague form, I think. But I want to ask you, before we get to that, I want to ask you about inflation, because these two things kind of go together. I was in Pennsylvania covering this American election, and almost everyone I talked to spoke about the rising cost of living in America. It was almost existential condition. How should we understand inflation, how it worked out in this election?
Well, let me first of all go back to the question of my father's experience. He was the last policymaker in the history of the United States to deal with inflation successfully. And how did he do it? The answer is they froze prices and then allowed adjustments according to what they thought was appropriate and manageable. I asked him how he found 17,000 people to administer price control in a matter of a few months in early 1942. He said, I hired all land-grant colleges. I hired all the economists. So at that time, one had a large group of people who had the practical knowledge and the capability. You wouldn't find them in economics departments now. They've all been almost completely eliminated. But that was the case at the end of the 1930s, the early 1940s. So you had an administrative capacity to intervene in this area and to do so effectively and to hold it. Well, he held it for a year and then it was replaced by a hold the line order, a complete freeze through the end of the war. So this was a draconian policy by later standards, although it was an extremely popular and extremely effective policy, and it completed a program that maintained macroeconomic balance in the United States during the war, so that people took their extra money, which they were earning in hand over fist that they'd never seen so much, and put it into savings bonds, which then spread the purchasing power out over the post-war period for the next 15 years. Very, very successful program, which then came under enormous withering fire from the economics profession as it was constituted after the war, and which then did everything they could to bring the whole experience of price control into, first of all, disrepute, and then to forget about it altogether, except as some bad dream that, you know, probably didn't really happen. And that's the way matters rested until this last episode, with all kinds of fantastic and fantastical theories about how central banks cause inflation, central banks cure inflation, how they influence expectations, all kinds of theological nonsense has become the mainstream dogma and the reflexive reaction of the press. Well, Isabella Weber, who is first and foremost a very talented economic historian and a student of practice in other countries, and most noticeably in China, where, by the way, the authorities were greatly influenced by the American World War II experience, as she discovered, and as I discovered actually separately in my own interactions with Chinese official diamond 30 years ago. And so she had the temerity to suggest that perhaps some of those tools would still be appropriate for what was going on in 2021, 2022. And what was going on was precisely a squeeze on costs. It was a push in energy prices combined with a disruption of supply chains that was causing, among other things, a shortage of new automobiles, which pushed up the price of used cars, and various other things which pushed up asset prices rather rapidly in this period. But the main thing was energy costs, which feed through to fuel and then disrupt the cost structure of the whole business system, creating a situation in which businesses basically scramble to restore their margins, and they end up in a kind of escalating spiral. And this shows up as an enormous increase in total profitability relative to wages. And what you need to do when that happens is have a mechanism that you can invoke that will get everybody to calm down and to go back to their normal behavior. Businesses don't normally like to gouge. They don't normally like, this is bad for reputation. They don't like to stand out with a sore thumb with a policy of grabbing as much as they can. And most of them don't. I mean, that's to say, just a general matter. But when they are forced by cost increases to raise their prices, well, they'll raise a little bit more than they might otherwise in order to protect against future cost increases and against the, you know, the behavior of all of their competitors and their market space, their suppliers, and so forth. So what you need to do then is to have an ability to, as I say, to get everybody to calm down, to return as quickly as possible to normal behavior, and then you won't have the kind of squeeze on real wages, which is what you observed in Pennsylvania, and which everybody observed, and which was, in fact, the main reason why President Biden's economic program was so heavily disliked in the country and regarded as a non-success. The administration, following the lead of the economics profession generally and their own economists who were not brave enough to stand up to this, said, it's the Fed's job. Let the Federal Reserve deal with it. And the Federal Reserve then raises interest rates, which has no effect on inflation, but does affect your ability to sell a home or to buy one. And your ability to borrow and the cost of borrowing. And it squeezes people even more. And it piles money in the form of interest payments into the hands of people who have a lot of money, which are people who have a lot of money have more money than people who don't have a lot of money. Yes, I'm paraphrasing my father on that, but that was one of Galbraith's laws. This is naturally not going to be looked upon favorably by the voting population.
So do you think actually that they, you know, she was mentioning not price controls because probably that would sound too controversial for some in America. But actually, you know, we had price controls here in Europe when the cost of gas were going up in Germany and France. The governments were actually controlling the prices of that for a while. So it's such a, I think it's such a weird phenomenon. On the one hand, you see governments in Germany and France that are not very socialist or not anti-capitalist in at any measure, they're doing it. And then when you have it suggested other places, it's considered socialist or anti-capitalist.
Oh, no, it's considered to be communistic, something which would only be done in some place like China, which, of course, happens to be the most successful economy in the world right now. It's a bit of a dilemma, but these measures are not unpopular with the public. They're always very popular because they directly affect public welfare. They're unpopular with the economics profession, which has been so socialized, if you like, that's a kind of an ironic term here, but which has been deeply conditioned and trained in the tradition of Milton Friedman to regard prices as the one thing you can't fiddle with, and that this would be allowed to adjust in order to solve practically every problem that the economy throws up. Just let the price system handle it. Well, this is, of course, a complete illusion, because the normal practice of businesses is precisely not to change their prices if they don't have to, and in order to that gives them a stable price structure is one which gives them a sense of what they can do, how they can plan, make investments, and have a reasonably positive return on their activities. And once the price system becomes unstable and starts adjusting all over the place, you lose the sense of stability and predictability. And that is, of course, a very bad thing for the future of economic activity, except for speculators, some of whom make a lot of money and some of whom lose a lot of money.
If we look at the Biden legacy, I think he's seen here from Denmark. A lot of what he did was something that we, from a progressive standpoint, really admired, the way that he revitalized the antitrust tradition, put in Lena Khan, the way he had some executive orders where he wanted to restore democratic power vis-a-vis capital, the way that he supported unions. He's probably the most pro-labor president in my lifetime. He had huge public investments programs. He had industrial policies. Some of the things that you've also been asking for. For us here, it's a kind of a riddle. Why was this president rejected by the working class of America? Or why was his policies rejected by the working class of America when he really tried to make policies for the working class? How do you see this question?
Well, first of all, I don't doubt the good faith of Biden's economists. They were by and large not drawn from the mainstream academic community, but largely from the Washington think tank community. But I would argue that they fell short in terms of their intellectual and political independence from mainstream economic thinking and doctrines. The major one, which I've just mentioned, is turning over the inflation fight to the Federal Reserve. Once you do that, of course, the Federal Reserve exists to ensure that the interests of big finance prevail over all other interests in the final analysis. So you can go on and give lots of subsidies to companies to do, for example, renewable energy projects. And then the interest rate goes up, and it causes, they have to borrow in order to finance these things, and they, it wreaks havoc with their projections and projects which might have been viable at a low interest rate do not be, are not viable at a higher one, and they get canceled, and that's happening all over the place. So there's that. But then when you just dig into the details of the industrial policy, and for that matter, I don't want to criticize. I think Lena Khan, I admire her as much as anybody else does. But antitrust is a tool, particularly when it is aimed at corporate misconduct, not necessarily at restructuring markets. Because the fact is, there are certain kinds of markets, which are network markets, which you have 10 competitors, they're all going to be less efficient than one. But the conduct of the quasi-monopoly that may be out there is a matter of crucial public policy importance, and it's important to have a strong antitrust enforcer who can intervene let's say, assert and enforce appropriate rules. So that's all okay, but it's really playing around at the margins with the structure of the economy. On the industrial side, they declared themselves as supportive of industrial policy. They enacted a number of very substantial bills, but one has to remember that this idea of industrial policy had been floating around for 40 or 50 years. I was part of the discussions at the origin of this in the late 70s and early 1980s from my perch on the congressional staff. And what has happened in those 40 or 50 years has been a tremendous decline in the capacity of the government to carry out that mission, a tremendous decline. That is to say, if you go back to the post-war period and even before that to the New Deal period, you could bring into government a strong group of engineers and technologists, scientists to design and implement and bring to fruition in a short period of time major new scientific projects, major new engineering works. And this was partly because of the scientific and technical climate of that time, and partly because the resource situation was very different from now, that oil had just come in as a major fuel. And so electrification and automobiles and roads and airplanes and airfields and so forth were things that you could do that you couldn't have done in the 19th century. Well, here we are, and we have basically a government that is whose major competence is writing checks and giving out tax subsidies. Now, when it comes to deciding whether one engineering project is appropriate better than another, they don't really have that ability to a significant extent. One of the things that I noticed some months ago was a letter from Elizabeth Warren and I think one of her colleagues to the Commerce Secretary, raising a concern that the Commerce Department had brought in a group of people from Wall Street to decide how to give out the funds under one of the major Biden industrial initiatives. Well, that's where you're going, thinking for your expertise. What you're going to get is the judgment of financial people. And you're going to get it from people whose commitment to the public sector and to the long term is not, is not what you would ideally like to have. Just necessarily. I'm not saying anything bad about those people. It's just that that's not what their expertise is. And you really don't have. If your expertise is financial engineers rather than real engineers, you've got a problem.
When I spoke to you 12 years ago, you were so kind to meet me back in Austin at the Romney-Obama election, and you'd just published Inequality.
It's ancient history. I'm surprised that your memory goes back that far.
No, because
that was, that was before we'd even heard of this guy. What is his name? Trump?
Yeah. But you just published Inequality and Instability. That was an eye-opening book for me to read at the time. And you said that Mitt Romney was the most open plutocrat in American politics in your lifetime, that he was the first plutocrat who had very little governing experience. He'd been a governor in Massachusetts, I think, for 4 years. And now we're 12 years later, and it seems to me that you have Elon Musk very close to Donald Trump, and it's all out in the open. And as someone from Denmark, if I told another person about this happening in Latin America, that you had this very rich guy promising money lotteries to register for votes and saying we should cut a third of the federal budget and buying an entire media that excluded his political ally, you'd say, well, this is not democratic. And I'm wondering, is what we're seeing now, is that just another chapter in the big book of the long battle between wealth and democracy in America, or is it at a more critical level in your view?
Well, I think it's definitely at a more critical level. And the way I would put it this way is the following. If you look at the period of what you might call high democracy or the approach to social democracy in the United States, which runs from Roosevelt through at least through Nixon and Ford into the Carter years, it really comes to an end in 1980. You're looking at a country whose political economy is framed by large organizations and institutions that exist in relation to those organizations, the large industrial corporations, the large trade unions, and a relatively capable, let's call it, well, my father called it scientific and engineering estate, independent in the universities with a certain amount of presence in the public sphere, plus a series of movements, consumer movements, women's movements, and environmental movement, which were framed by combination of activists and lawyers and public-spirited people. That was it was an approach to democracy, if you like, because at least ordinary people in many cases had some avenue for the consolidation, organization, expression of their core interests, and they would get accommodated to some degree. Well, with the erosion of the industrial core, which really started in the mid-1970s and has been going on for ever since, what you have is the rise of an economy that's dominated by finance, insurance, the FIRE sector, finance, insurance, real estate. It's headquartered on the East Coast, technology headquartered on the West Coast, plus some, the admixture of entertainment and the energy industries and so forth and the military contractors. But in the Democratic Party, it's finance and technology. And those are intensely concentrated. The banking sector, which was very, very diffuse in the 1970s, is now heavily concentrated in, 15 or 20 large banks. And the technology sector is dominated by a handful of firms with a handful of extremely prominent people. And we know their names. I mean, Bezos and Musk and Gates and so forth. So we have a kind of oligarchic clique, which has enormous sway in the country and which controls the remains of stratospheric commanding heights of the American economy. And they and a number of others provide the funding to both parties. And what the public exists for is a funding base of small donations. And to provide votes on request if they can be motivated to do that. But the public doesn't care for that very much, which is why Kamala Harris lost the election. She got 7 million fewer votes in 2024 than Joe Biden did in 2020. Trump picked up a couple of million relative to what he earned, what he got in 2020. But the Democrats lost 7 million. It's the people who simply wouldn't vote for the candidate. Now, why is that? That might have been that the elections were more harder to access. The polling place in the United States is typically made quite difficult to access for busy people, working people, poor people. And it was very easy in 2020 because of the pandemic, but a lot of that went away. And you know, a lot of that's just disaffection. They didn't feel that the party was offering them anything that made it worthwhile to go out and vote. And so I need to focus on that fact that you really see a drop. The test of a drop off of democracy is when the validating thing, which is the willingness of people to go out and cast a ballot, starts to fade away.
But if we compare this era now, where you really have this world of finance that you describe and technology, and you have it in both parties, to what happened in America in the 1890s, where you also had the Gilded Age, that was succeeded by the progressive era, and you had a period of progressive reforms that were kind of, in my school book view, it's like democracy struck back against concentrated wealth. Do you see that happening again? Do you see another progressive era, or do you see a way for democracy to strike back against these very, very strong economic stakeholders that you have now?
Well, interestingly, since you mentioned the 1890s, I think it was the election of 1896, which was, of course, the William Jennings Bryan, the Democrat who absorbed the Populist Party and the Populist platform. And I believe it was that election had the highest turnout of the eligible voters, which, of course, was men and almost all white men, than since up until 2020. So in 2020, you had a sign of what happens when you really make it possible for the whole electorate to vote and make it relatively easy, which there were many, many things: early voting, vote by mail, 24-hour voting, drive-through voting, all kinds of innovations which had not been seen and which many of which were retracted. So there's a real, I think, a base of comparison. But in 2020, the Democratic candidate, Joe Biden, was an artifact of the Democratic establishment, behind whom all the party leaders consolidated precisely to prevent the William Jennings Bryan of 2020, namely Bernie Sanders, from winning the nomination. So actually, the parallel is not bad at all. Now we have a situation in which everything is now up in the air. And let's remember the fact that the guy who actually won the 2024 election was Donald Trump. And Trump is he's obviously not the standard Republican candidate. He doesn't represent to the same degree the standard Republican power centers. His administration, as it comes in, is strikingly original. I don't necessarily like or dislike the whole thing, but it's certainly the most remarkably original and nonconformist group that I can remember offhand seeing composed. I actually think it's even more so than Kennedy's administration in 1961. With a remarkable outreach to several prominent former Democrats, with obviously facing the very great challenge of dealing with the obvious direction of the policy in Europe and Ukraine, and vis-a-vis Russia and other major challenges. And so it is possible that the underlying constituency basis of American politics will be rearranged by this. It's also possible that it will completely fall apart, which is what basically happened in Trump's first term. There was no coherent strategy, but we don't know. I mean, I think the jury is out and has to remain out for the time being. I'll say one other thing on this. In 2016, Trump didn't expect to win. He didn't really want to win, and he certainly didn't know what to do once he became president-elect. But there were 8 years further on, you know, it's obvious that he and the people around him have a much stronger sense of who they can rely on and who they should stay clear of. And so we just have to see how this plays out.
I want to ask you about your new book, because you have a book that's coming out next year. I think it's 2025.
Well, physical copies will be ready in a few weeks, I'm told.
Oh, we look very much forward to that. There's been references made to it in some of your columns and in an interview done by Project Syndicate. I want to just pick up on one specific point before we go to the big argument of the book, is that you make a... you write about the difference between free tariffs, free trade and tariffs, or you write about how we should understand free trade and tariffs, because I think right now in Europe, we're at a moment where people are thinking, free trade, that was for neoliberalists. That was the legacy of Washington Consensus. Now we have something else. We have tariffs coming up. And if you saw the interview with Christine Lagarde in Financial Times, you can see how scared the European establishment is of the tariffs, the threat of tariffs. It's really an efficient political instrument as a threat for Donald Trump, the tariffs. We tend to see it as two very different ideological regimes, free trade and tariffs. But it seems to me that you have a different reading of that in your new book.
Oh, well, not just in my new book, but I've written about this quite a bit. I mean, the history of protected industrial development is very long, and practically every country that has come up in the world against a dominant power, the United States against Britain, Germany, the Asian countries, China, all did so behind substantial protective tariffs. So this is, you know, if you think about this in the terms that would describe it in our book, this is called infinite industry policy for a reason. That is, you obviously do not put your newborn infant out on the street, in the first days of its life. You nurture them for a period of time, and then you have to make a decision about when you boot them out of the house and let them live on their own. Every parent knows this. And so this is an entirely normal thing for national policymakers to consider doing. The idea that free trade is a universal ideology is, again, it's an old idea. It comes out of the period of high British imperialism, when Britain was the industrially dominant power. The United States did not accept it then. The United States took it over when the U.S. became the dominant industrial power. And now the U.S. is no longer the dominant industrial power, and so it's naturally retreating from this doctrine. Whether it can make a protectionist strategy work to revive a declining industrial sector, or one which has already heavily declined, is a very problematic problem, in which certainly the British would not succeed in doing so. So where are we with respect to Europe? And I think the answer needs to be faced rather straightforwardly, which is, I see no reason to think that the policymakers in the United States care about the effect of their policies on Europe. They are, I think, quite happy with a policy which, because of the not only the protection angle, the tariffs, but also the very great difference in energy costs between the U.S. and Europe, thanks to Europe cutting itself off from Russian energy, that they will get the investment of major European, especially German firms, coming into the United States to do their work in the U.S., which will be good for American manufacturing, for American workers, for technical development, engineering capacity, all of that. So I think what Europeans need to recognize is that this government of the United States, and I would expect future governments, is looking out for the American interest. And the European interest, well, if you want to see the European interest advanced, you have to have a political class that understands what it is, and you don't.
Thank you. I'll take that advice with me, and that very dire diagnosis, which I happen to share. Well, I want to hear about the basic argument of your new book, because you've been a critic of mainstream economy for as long as I can remember. It's been a core of your work, and I have the expectation that the book that you have coming up is kind of your final break or leap into a new political theory. Is that correct?
Well, it distills the core ideas down to their essentials, and the basic argument here is that the fundamental foundation of an economic activity is not the market, it's not distribution, it is the production of that which then gets to be distributed, And production is a process which occurs through time and which depends upon the scale of the eventual sales, the value of the product you can produce, the cost of your resources, your ability to make a fixed investment in order to engage in production, and the plans that you have to carry that out. So all of this is entirely homologous. It's the same process that governs any biological entity and any mechanical entity. So it would basically unify economics with physics, biology, anthropology, with all the rest of modern science, which is evolutionary, which operates through time, and which understands that you tap into low entropy sources in order to do anything. And that, then, once you sort of stated those basic principles, the resources are quality resources are crucial, plans are necessary, fixed investment is necessary, regulation of the resulting market structures is absolutely necessary. Then you have simplified economics in a way which is, first of all, it's mathematically very tractable. You can explain this to any high school student. And intuitive, it brings to an end or challenges the cognitive dissonance that every student of economics has when they sit down and they're confronted with this notion that there's some magical force that's going to give them an equilibrium result with the forces of supply and demand balanced and prices and quantities, and this is going to continue in a stable way through the end of time with the result of a steadily increasing growth of the economy. And all of that, it just dissolves as an artifact of a set of ideologies that really passed out of scientific fashion in the middle of the 19th century in every other field. So we're not doing something which is new, but we are bringing some very core ideas and saying, this is how you can apply them to economics and make sense out of economic processes.
It seems to me that what you spoke about with your father's origins in the beginning, that it's about taking economy out of this highly specialized abstract academic field and then back to the real world to a certain extent.
Well, that's one way of putting it, and I'm certainly not opposed to phrasing it that way. I would stress that the highly abstract academic view is an artifact of the way things were thought about in the 18th century. If you want a parallel notion of intelligent design, perhaps is in biology is a parallel. The notion of, it actually goes back much further. It goes back to classical Chinese philosophy, yin and yang, so the balance of forces under the celestial harmony. It was an idea that was very congenial in France and was upset by the French Revolution. In the 19th century, science moved on and became an investigation of processes, became an investigation of essentially of dynamics, and eventually of thermodynamics. And that's where the concept of entropy begins to play its crucial role. And the reality is economics never caught up. Mainstream economics, in fact, repressed and has repressed every effort to bring 20th century science, 19th and 20th century science. It repressed the institutionalists who were led by Veblen and Commons. It repressed Keynes, who was inspired by Einstein and the theory of relativity. That's why he called his book The General Theory. I've written about that. And it certainly has not accepted the second law of thermodynamics as a foundation for thinking about economic issues. Once you start thinking in those terms, can't go back. It's too easy. And it enables you to think about practical questions in a sensible way. I made an application of this, which has been quite successful and very widely noticed, to the problem of sanctions. The theory behind the sanctions held that if you just pulled away the building blocks of the Russian economy, capital, labor, technology, management, money, the Russian economy would crumble. And that was a neoclassical theory. You write down a production function, remove the factors of production, each of which has got its own little market, labor market, capital market, and so forth. And then the place will fall apart. And what actually happened, when you look at what the sanctions did, was it created for Russia what did not exist before, a protected market for internal industries with very good resource conditions, because Russia has its own oil and gas and so forth, can sell them internally at very favorable prices, in a situation in which the capital equipment, which the Western firms abandoned, was sold to Russian entrepreneurs at very low prices. So look, someone who's doing business says, that's a profit opportunity. And after a period of adjustment, and there was major disruption, but after a period of adjustment, the Russian economy began to grow and has been growing for the last 2 years. So it's now, according to the IMF, the fourth largest economy in the world. That's exactly the opposite of what the sanctions designers thought would happen. And they warned, it wasn't because the sanctions were evaded. They were successful. It was because they were successful. But the people implementing them were operating on a standard economic theory, which is completely not applicable to the real world. This is what we observe. Whereas in Europe, the effect of the sanctions, of course, was to raise the price of resources and to reduce market space, because Russian markets became unavailable to European firms, with the result that profitability has declined and the European economy is at best stagnant and in certain places in recession, and that major firms that are heavily dependent upon energy resources, particularly in Germany, have been closing out or moving their resources, their facilities to the United States. And again, perfectly predictable. If you're operating on the basis of the simple framework that we advance in our book, perfectly understandable. But if you're operating on the neoclassical framework, and you expect that substitution will cause everything to come out okay. And I say, people who want to can hold to those beliefs, good luck to you. You're going to end up bankrupt, not just intellectually, but also financially.
I have one last question, which is, I remember I was also covering the 2008 election in America, and it was very interesting because you had the financial crisis was everywhere, but nobody really understood it. You know, it was affecting people's lives, but it was very hard for people to explain actually what just happened. And it seemed to me that there was a gap between the financial systems that were deciding people's lives and then the everyday life that they could comprehend and deliberate about. Is this also an ambition with your book to give kind of the economic management of society back to common sense, and so that it can be part of, you know, common everyday democratic deliberation?
I would hope so, yes. I did deal with the financial crisis at length in an earlier book called The End of Normal. I would take exception to the view that no one understood it. There were plenty of people who understood it, but they had no significant access to the public sphere. And so you had a dominant narrative which said nobody could have predicted this. Well, the question is, lots of nobodies did predict it, but the problem was they were nobodies and nobody paid attention to what they were saying. And then we ask, what has happened since then? In particularly since in academic economics, have these lessons been absorbed? Has there been a revolution in academic thinking? The answer is no, not at all. Did any of the major economics departments in the United States or in Europe seek out any of the people who gave a correct analysis of what was happening to the financial system and offer them the highest level appointments in academic economics? No, not one. Were any of their articles published in the so-called top journals? No, not that I'm aware of. What you had instead was, the Nobel Committee gave a prize to Mr. Bernanke, who remarks, that it was quite accurately that banks did not have any role to play in the models that he was brought up with and that he continued to believe in right up to the moment of the disaster when he was chairman of the Central Bank of the United States. This is really extraordinary. It really shows an incapacity of the academic institutions of the world's most significant central economic financial power to adjust to the clearest demonstration of the inadequacy of their ideas. And why is that? Because they don't want to. because they don't want to. And this is what you have to raise your voice against.
Well, and we really do look very much forward to Entropy Economics, the living basis of value and production, coming out next year. You'll have physical copies in a couple of weeks. We'll probably have it in the first quarter of next year. James Galbraith, thank you so much for taking your time and talking to us yet again. I hope we'll talk in 12 years again.
Well, I hope it's sooner than that. I've enjoyed it very much. Thank you.
Det var min samtale med James Galbraith, og den bog, vi talte om, som er hans kommende hovedværk, hedder Entropy Economics. Den udkommer på The University of Chicago Press, og den er skrevet sammen med en anden økonom, som hedder Ying Chen. Den her samtale var ligesom de foregående sat sammen og produceret og redigeret af vores vidunderlige ven og hjælper Samuel Krogh Larsen. I næste uge, der går vi videre ned ad det her spor, og der markerer vi indsættelsen af Donald Trump med et interview med den amerikanske Nobelprismodtager i økonomi, Joseph Stiglitz, så vi fortsætter i sporet, og så tager vi det et skridt videre. Tak fordi I lyttede med den her gang. Jeg lover jer, hvis I også lytter med næste gang, så følger der et brag af en oplevelse.